Reset your system clock to 1992 and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Super VGA, and in today's episode, I'm going to talk about my first experiences with the wonderful Windows 3.1. Hi, new listeners, and welcome to the podcast. It's good to be here. I'm your host, Super VGA.
Originally, I was going to focus on some unloved DOS titles, but as I start to go through the list of games for DOS, I noticed that quite a few of the unpolished gems I was coming up with were actually Windows 3.1 games that no one talked about, besides on, you know, forums and maybe Wikipedia pages. Besides, there are also some really great DOS podcasts out there, like Upper Memory Block and DOS Nostalgia, so I didn't want to kind of tread over already familiar territory. So in this show, I'm going to publish one episode a week, and we're going to cover applications, utilities, games from the Windows 3.1 and the pre-95 era. That's kind of where I've set my cutoff point, although it's kind of a fuzzy point anyway, because in that time, even in the Windows 95 era, people were still making Windows 3.1 compatible software. They were trying to cover both parts of the spectrum, just because even when Windows 95 was very mature, people were still using Windows 3.1 for a lot of stuff, especially in your grandmother's little computer room, or in business and productivity environments where compatibility with 95 wasn't always available. So everyone knows Solitaire and Minesweeper, at least everyone who grew up with 3.1, but do you remember Ski Free? How about Rodent's Revenge or Cosmology of Kyoto? Or in my case, my favorite application for Windows 3.1, After Dark, which was a screensaver, and my favorite was definitely the Simpsons After Dark module. Most of us grew up with paint.exe, but did you mess around with Adobe Premiere or Macromedia Director? Or did you do any 3D modeling with a program called Caligari TrueSpace 2? How about learning object-oriented programming? Did you do any work with Windows Visual Basic 3? Or do any MIDI composition with a program called Cakewalk? I can tell you that I used most of these myself at some point in my life. So I'm definitely going to be covering these applications in future episodes. I'm also going to focus on the early internet, because it became possible in the early 90s to dial up from your home PC for the first time. So for anyone who remembers this, you might remember configuring Trumpet Winsock to use a SLIP or PPP connection. In my case, it was a SLIP connection. You'd have to, you know, kind of dial in using Trumpet Winsock, which would hook up your Windows sockets to have TCP/IP access. And then after that, you'd fire up a copy of Netscape 1.0 or NCSA Mosaic. If you're old like me, you might recognize some of those names. In future episodes, I'd love to talk about Windows 3.1 era hardware, like the 386, 486, and Pentium, even though, yes, I know, this overlaps plenty with DOS. The way that these processors actually interacted with Windows itself is very interesting. So we might even talk about the 286, because the 286 supported Windows modes that are very different than the kind of Windows modes we use today. How about setting up the MIDI mapper on your Roland Sound Canvas if you were, you know, kind of rich enough to own a Roland SC55 back in the day, or, you know, an SC88? What about your Windows Sound System compatible card? Windows Sound System, you know, became possible in the Windows 3.1 era. What about your Sound Blaster 16? Did it have an IDE controller built into it so you could plug your CD-ROM drive into it using an IDE cable? In my case, I'll talk about this in some future episode or possibly today, my True Blue Sound Blaster 16 had a Mitsumi compatible IDE. I don't even want to call it an IDE port, but it used IDE pins on it to support my CD-ROM drive, which was, of course, a Mitsumi. Oh, I just lied. I just realized something. It was not a Mitsumi CD-ROM drive. My memory just kicked in here. It was actually a Matsushita Kotobuki, and I know I'm mispronouncing this, MKE Electronics, if you remember that. It was a double-speed MKE drive, so that was not Mitsumi. I'm sorry. So we're going to talk about stuff like that. If you've got a topic suggestion, I'd love to hear it. I'm not going to be a stickler about dates or anything like that. So basically, if it's Windows 3.1 related, I'd love to talk about it on the show. And and please write in with your memories of games and applications or hardware from that era. So let's get on with the first episode. So here's a little story about how I came to Windows 3.1 myself. It was, I think, 1994. So this is a little late in the game. Windows 3.1 had already been out for a couple of years. We had, up to this point, an Amstrad 286 PC. It was unfortunately dead after an unhappy accident where I tried to seat my AdLib sound card in backwards. Or maybe it didn't even go in backwards. I might have just had it slightly off kilter when I put it into the back of the machine. And when I hit the power button, I heard this metallic pop. And I could smell this acrid burning plastic electronic smell. And I knew I had done in our machine. So I kind of lied to my mom. She tried to boot the machine, I think, later on that day. And I said, oh, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with it. And, she couldn't get into her favorite word processing program in DOS called Easy Working 8-in-1. She was trying to type up a paper or something. So she took it to a local computer shop. In fact, it was the only local computer shop that was willing to work on the British-made Amstrad. And about a week later, the person from the computer shop called and left an answering machine message that said it was going to cost about $1,000 for a new motherboard. The motherboard was fried. It wasn't something simple like a power supply unit. And not only that, it would also take about 6 to 12 weeks to get one shipped in from the UK, because at that point, even though the computer was sold in Canada, where I'm from, the actual hardware was still being produced in Britain. So I somehow convinced my mom and dad that buying a new computer was the only option at this point. To this day, I don't really know how I did it. I reminded them, I think, that CD-ROM drives had been out for a while, and just a CD-ROM drive alone was going to cost us a fortune. I may have inflated the prices a little bit artificially. I do remember them being very expensive. You'll have to remember that in Canada, not only was our dollar worth a lot less than the American dollar, I want to say it was about 60 to 75 cents on the dollar compared to US dollars. Even after the exchange rate, the costs of electronics in Canada were very high. You could generally count on something being at least one third more expensive in Canada than it was in the United States. So I want to say that an external, parallel port based double speed CD-ROM drive in Canada would cost about $800 at that time. Tell me if I'm wrong. I could be misremembering this, but I seem to remember it being very, very, very high. And that was for an external drive, of course, because our Amstrad did not have any 5 1/4 inch disk ports that we could use. And there were no free ports. It was not like a computer tower you'd have today where you'd have, you know, a big stack of available ports to stick it into. The case was pre-molded. It only allowed for a single 3 1/2 inch drive, and that was it. So the other thing that I kind of convinced my folks about was that after tearing apart our Amstrad, actually the reason why I had put in that ad-lib card backwards or improperly was because I had torn the entire machine apart that day trying to figure out if there was RAM expansion slots on the motherboard. This was a 286 8 megahertz. I think it was called the PC2086/30. The computer shop that I had called that morning had said, well, if you want to upgrade to a 1 or 2 megabyte, upgraded by 1 or 2 megabytes, you're going to need to find out what kind of RAM it takes. So I tore the entire machine apart. And when I say tore it apart, I mean, today, when you open up a new tower, you pop off the cover and you have pretty much instantaneous access to its drives and its motherboard and, you know, any slots it has. This Amstrad was really not user-friendly. In fact, I think there was a warning on it, a sticker that said, you know, no user serviceable parts inside. And it had these layers of electromagnetic shielding on it just to prevent you from, well, not only to prevent it from, you know, pushing out EMF interference, but also to prevent you from getting at it. So once I had torn it down to its motherboard, which took, I want to say, over an hour and tons of screws, I had found out that the RAM was soldered onto the board. There was absolutely no way of upgrading it. So this only added to my argument that, you know, our only option is to get a new machine instead of upgrade. So adding all of this up together, I had kind of guesstimated that it was going to cost us $1,500 to $2,000 just to get our 286 up to a slightly more modern era. And let's, you know, let's also admit something, that I was probably jacking up the price quite a bit because I wanted to convince my folks that we wanted a new machine instead. And then, of course, when we got the the quote back from the computer shop guy, my mom was not going to let our house go for 2 to 3 months without a working computer. She was a university student at the time. She needed to write papers. And she knew that me and my sister were computer addicts, so she wasn't going to have us bumming around the house complaining about having no computer the entire summer. So we went to, our family packed ourselves into our 1989 Ford Aerostar van, if you can remember those, or if your country even had those. It was a minivan, one of the kind of first most popular minivans in Canada. We went to a new brick and mortar store called The Future Shop. Think of it as Canada's reply to Best Buy. It had recently opened up in my city and was selling computers kind of at the mid-peak of the computer craze. Keep in mind, this is 1994, right? The internet hasn't quite made big inroads yet into the everyday, home, everyday family PC. But people were very sensitive to this idea that every house needs a computer. So we went straight there, not because it was the best computer store in the city, but because my dad knew that he could get a Future Shop credit card. This was the early 90s, and we were still kind of coming out of a deep recession that had started in 1990-ish. I remember that my family was kind of always broke at this time, and my parents were always paying for things on credit card because they knew that, you know, they could at least squeeze another 30 days to 3 months out of a purchase by putting it on the credit card. You know, then that's the losing battle. So if my family was going to drop a couple $1,000s on a new computer, it was going to have to be on credit. And the Future Shop offered this Future Shop, I think it was just called the Future Shop credit card or something like that, or Future Shop credit line. And this allowed you to have, it was kind of a deal of 6 months no payment, 6 months of no interest on your purchase. Unfortunately, after that, if you didn't pay for the entire thing at the end of the 6 month term, you owed the entire 6 months worth of interest on your purchase. So it was kind of a scam in some ways. If you somehow forgot your date of purchase, you would get charged for the entire 6 months worth of interest. So anyway, that's just a bit of background. When we went into the store, I'll remember really specifically, it was sparkling clean compared to most computer shops at the time. Most computer shops were kind of dank. I'm trying to remember what the average computer shop looked like. It would have this fuzzy, I don't know what to call it, fuzzy low-pile commercial carpeting. There would be only a few computers out for display because these computer shops didn't have a lot of stock. They would basically keep everything in the back. You would go to your local computer person and say, oh, I want to buy a 386 SX20. And the guy would come out with the parts one at a time, and then you'd go through your parts list and he would, price them out. The Future Shop was very different. They had pre-built machines. Everything was pre-built. You could buy hardware upgrades, but the point of going to the store was to buy a fully, ready to go in the box machine that you would take home, pull out of the box, put it on your desk, and it would work. That was a fairly new idea in the 1990s, and I think that was part of the reason why Future Shop was fairly popular. So they would sell brand name machines like the Compaq Presario, or in our case, the IBM PS1. So there were two large rows of computers, and most of them were desktops. This is what I mean by, pre-made machines, pre-built machines. They were in a long row on a high table, and you could just go up to them and start messing around with them. And all of them had mice connected and keyboards, so you could do whatever you wanted to them. They weren't locked out, so you could actually go into the operating system and mess around. And all of them, I actually remember this very specifically, had the Windows, I don't know what to call it, the Flying Windows screensaver running on them, if you remember that from 3.1. And the first row had kind of the powerhouse computers. Like I said, most of them were desktops, but there were quite a few that were these huge towers. And, today when we think of a huge tower, we think of like a mini ATX case. I mean, these were really big. They were, probably 3.5 feet tall. Some of them were 4 feet tall, and they would have half a dozen 5.25-inch drive bays in them. And those are the powerhouse machines. I remember very specifically, one glance at the price kind of told the story. They were over $4,000 for a Pentium 60. And I don't know what that translates to in 2018 prices, but at the time it was a lot of money. It was unimaginable to spend $4,000 on a computer. The look from my parents' faces was pretty obvious that we were not going to be dropping that much dough on a machine that day. So we kind of skipped right past the first table of machines, and we went to the second row. And this was like their value price machines. It was all 386s and 486s. And I remember my dad letting out this big sigh, kind of like this huge annoying sigh, like he was going to throw a tantrum, because I think he had been looking at these big bright red price tags on them. They were like $29.99, $24.99. And even though for our family, those prices were way more within reach than a $4,000 computer, $1,000, I think it was $1,000, maybe $1,200 for a 386 at the time. And most of the 486s were in the $2,000 to $2,500 range. That was still an incredible amount of money for my family, who were struggling financially at the time. So my dad went straight to the beginning of the row, like the farthest end of the store, which was the cheapest machine. You know, the closest machine to the front entrance were kind of the most expensive ones. And I was just, kind of face-palming at the time, thinking, oh my God, we're going to end up with some low-budget 386 that's barely going to cut it. It's barely an upgrade from our 286. And I remember just kind of panicking, thinking, oh no, I hope we're not going to go home with this machine that's barely faster than our 286 and it only has a little bit more RAM. I'm like, no, I want something that's a lot more powerful, because my best friends at the time, these were two twin brothers, had a 486 DX33, and they had already had this for a couple of years. This was a very, very fast machine. Our Amstrad 286 was a pile of junk compared to their 486. You know, on my machine, the best thing I could hope for was playing Out of This World or Another World for Europeans at kind of 5 to 10 frames per second at most, with on the lowest quality audio settings. I mean, on their 486, Out of This World was so unimaginably fast that it was actually hard to play. And of course, we were playing, you know, the title to get for your 486 was Wing Commander 2. And in fact, their 486 not only had, you know, this fantastic looking, these fantastic looking graphics, but they also had digitized speech, because our 286 had an Adlib sound card, which had an OPL2 music synthesizer, which gave you kind of this nice buzzy, beepy kind of upgrade to the PC speaker. But their 486 had a real true blue Sound Blaster 1.0. So that meant that they got digitized speech. We did not have digitized speech on our Adlib, because that's not something the Adlib supported. So the best I could do for digitized speech was, if you remember a DOS game called Ghostbusters 2, which had kind of these scratchy digitized voices that would come out of the PC speaker, and when they came out of the speaker, they would actually freeze up the machine. So, you know, compared to that, the Sound Blaster was amazing. So I wanted something at least that matched up with my friend's 486. And honestly, I wanted something that was actually a little bit faster than theirs, so I could kind of thumb it in their faces. So I went over to, you know, keep in mind, my dad is at the end of the row, kind of looking, you know, frowning at this, you know, 386 for $1,000 in a vain attempt to understand what it is he was looking at. I went immediately to the 486 DX266. I thought, oh man, that was a beautiful machine. I mean, 66 megahertz, you were getting into Pentium territory at that point. So my mom kind of followed me over to this machine that I was drooling at, and she just gave me one look that said, no chance, bud, because it was $3,000. I think it was $29.99. So I kind of wandered over to the middle of the row, and it was a middle of the road price machine, and it was $24.99.99, something like that. And the big selling point was it was an IBM. My parents knew that name. And after all the trouble we had with the British-built Amstrad, even though that trouble was actually my fault, it had nothing to do with the machine itself. My parents wanted to buy something that they said was going to last. If you had parents in that era, the idea was you'd always buy, I mean, for them, buying a computer was like buying a pair of shoes. The logic was you could kind of grow into it if you bought something good enough. And most importantly for them, it had to be a decent brand that we could at least get a few school years out of. So again, they were willing to drop a few extra dollars on an IBM compared to the Amstrad we had owned, which came from the UK, which was difficult to get serviced, and you know, the parts were far away and very expensive. So I don't know when the decision was made to buy that particular machine, but I remember my dad kind of, I was only maybe 12 years old at that point. I was probably more like 13 or 14. My father kind of deferred to me for kind of technical decisions, because he knew I was into computers. So he must have saw that I was spending a lot of time with this machine, and he did not want to spend $2,500 on a computer, I can tell you that much. So he pulled the sales kid aside, who at most could have been 18 or 19 years old, and started wheeling and dealing with him. My dad hated big box stores like this. He was more used to, he had grown up in, you know, in a rough little town, which had secondhand stores and classified ads. And the idea behind that is you could at least bargain in person with the person you were buying something from. He hated the idea of paying sticker price for something. He thought that was insanity to pay retail prices for anything. So he was a complete nightmare, for instance, to go to, I'll never forget this. This is a little off topic, but it's funny. We went to a jean store. I wanted to buy my first pair of jeans as a 12-year-old kid. So we went to this local jean store, I believe was called Below the Belt. And we went inside and, you know, it's an teen's jean store. I mean, there's nothing special about it, except for the fact that this is the first time in my life, my father's life, he had ever saw jeans that cost over $40. I think they were $59.99 for a pair of jeans. And, you know, they were kind of designer jeans, and I wanted to fit in with my friends. And I was so mortified because I went and picked up the jeans, tried them on. You know, this is like 1990. They're baggy, ugly, baggy jeans. Brought them to the front and said, yeah, I want these ones, Dad. And he said, okay. And he went over to the salesman and started bargaining with the salesman. And I was just mortified because I'm standing, you know, 5 feet behind him. And my dad's trying to get this pimply teenager to bargain, to lower the price for him. So it was effectively the same thing with a computer, except on a much larger scale. So my dad kind of managed to find a good bargaining chip. When he asked to outright buy the computer, the kids said that they were out of boxes on the shelf and all they had left was the floor model. So my dad immediately knew that buying a floor model was somehow going to be in his favor because he could say, well, it's used. I'm not paying full price for something used. that's me attempting to imitate my dad. So the kid did the best thing he could do within his tiny amount of power he had, which meant, you know, I don't want to go ask my sales manager to drop the price, and I also want to have the largest possible commission off of this because Future Shop employees were paid on commission. He gave my dad a free printer with a machine in exchange for taking the floor model. This was a Canon Bubblejet 200E. I think it was worth a few hundred bucks at the time. I think I saw that the list price was $300, so it was probably closer to $400 in Canada. And I was super impressed because this was a small, light inkjet printer compared to our incredibly heavy Star NX dot matrix printer that we'd been using for years. And, you know, the move from dot matrix to an inkjet was a big deal because, for instance, you would not hear a dot matrix going, like, you know, this was very loud, way louder than I can do it on a mic. It would take over this, you know, an entire house in terms of its noise. The 200E, the bubble jet, was incredibly quiet. I mean, you could barely hear the print head moving. So I think this must have placated my dad enough because he must have known, oh, wow, it's worth $400. So that means I've basically gotten something for free. And honestly, he must have seen this kind of drug addicted look I had on my face that basically said, unless we go home with this computer right now, I'm going to throw a spaz for the entire car ride and the rest of the week. I wanted it that bad. But my sister and I were kind of greedy. We wanted games for it. We didn't want just, you know, the average productivity. It came with Microsoft Works, if you remember that piece of software, which we will most definitely have to cover in a future episode. We wanted some games for it. I had grown up with, you know, DOS games all of my life. And all of a sudden, it was possible to have Windows 3.1-based CD-ROM games. This was a new thing for us. But after dropping $2,500 on a new machine, I mean, this was a no-go. There was no way my dad was going to spend an extra $60 to $75 on a brand new computer game, no matter how cool it was. So I didn't want to push my luck. The salesman could see how disappointed I was and said, you know, he kind of looked at me and said, tell you what, I can throw in some free software for it. And as it turns out, his generosity was a bit on the disingenuous side. This was actually the pack-in software that was supposed to come with the computer. I mean, this was the stuff that IBM put in the box for you, but he was kind of implying that, you know, I'm doing you a favor, kid. So we got some basic productivity stuff, like I said, Microsoft Works. Another one was Compton's Interactive Encyclopedia. But we got some other cool stuff like San Diego Zoo's The Animals, which I do want to cover on a future episode. In fact, I want to cover both of those at some point. But we didn't know that. We didn't know that this was supposed to be built in or packed in with the machine. As far as we were, and he came with this big stack of CDs. He came from the back because they had put all of the floor models CDs into the back of the store, and he came out with this big stack of CDs. So my dad thought, oh, wow, you know, we're getting a hell of a deal here. We were farmers that lived out in the boondocks. We didn't really understand how big box brick and mortar stores worked. This made my dad really happy. He just loved the illusion of getting something for free. So we brought the machine home in the back of our Aerostar, and my sister and I tore apart the boxes as soon as we got into the house. My dad actually stood a few feet away from us because he was worried that we'd somehow destroy his $2,500 investments just by, you know, kind of opening up the boxes. He was so stressed out by just watching us, you know, opening up his machine that he had to leave the room. I think he just was kind of thinking, well, they know what they're doing more than me, and I'm just going to lose my temper here watching them drop something, and better not to see it. My sister and I finally managed to get the entire Windows system installed, and we were in love with the machine. Not only did it play back our old DOS games, but this was the first time that we could spend time in Windows 3.1. Our prior machine, the Amstrad, had actually Windows 2.0 built in, and we'll talk about that in the rest of this episode, where Windows 2.0 was kind of just basically a file information manager. Windows 3.1 actually had built-in applications that were pretty good. Not only that, but the Windows games it came with were wonderful. It had a copy of King's Quest V, where my DOS machine, my Amstrad machine, was a 16-color EGA version of King's Quest. This was the 256-color Windows MPC multimedia version of it. For anyone who doesn't know what MPC means, it meant multimedia PC, which was a standard that Microsoft had started, which had the intent of standardizing some basic PC hardware that would allow people to use multimedia applications. In fact, the IBM PS1 that we bought, and I haven't even told you what the specs were, was, I believe, the MPC-2 specification, which meant, and I'm going to have to look this up at some point, which meant that it satisfied some of the basic requirements for MPC-2 level certification. The PS1 we bought had, I believe, I know, a 486 SX33 CPU, which will big time play a role in some of the software that I could use in the future. It had 4 megabytes of RAM, and it had a double-speed MKE CD-ROM drive. And I believe it also actually, in fact, I have it on hand right here. It also had an IBM H3256-A3 hard drive. If I remember correctly, this was about a 250-meg hard drive. We'll also talk about this hard drive on a future episode, because the actual drive I'm holding in my hands right now crashed about 20 years ago. So I may actually pay to send this out for data recovery. And we can talk about on a future episode what's exactly on this machine. It's like a time capsule from 20 years ago. If I manage to get some of the data recovered, that might be a lot of fun. So my sister and I fell in love with the 486. I mean, this occupied the family den for the rest of my junior high and high school life. And it didn't come to its demise until years and years and years later, after I had completely gutted the machine. And I cringe saying this, and I apologize to anybody who's into PC collecting. I gutted the machine and threw out the motherboard and case, including the PSU. I've spent years trying to find a replacement PS1, but they're ungodly expensive these days, and I'm not going to drop the bucks on that. So that's the story of how I got my first experiences with Windows 3.1. I hope you join me. I hope you join me on a future episode of the Multimedia Hyper Guide podcast. And in a future episode, we're going to talk about a brief history of Windows 3.1 and maybe take a look at some of the recent thrift store finds I've had. So thank you once again for listening to the show. I'd love for you to write in if you have some ideas for future episodes or want to kind of plus one of the episode ideas I mentioned that can kind of push it ahead in the queue, please do. My email address is vga@vga256.com. That's vga@vga256.com. All right, folks, you have a great week, and I'll talk to you next Sunday. Finally, a personal note to listeners. When I recorded the first episode of this podcast way back in 2018, I was starting to write a book about growing up with computers of the 80s and 90s, modems, bulletin board systems, and even the early internet. It took several years to write it all down, but I managed to weave together over 80 of those stories, many of which I allude to in this podcast, into a novel-length book. It's called Mages and Modems, a childhood well wasted in the golden age of personal computers, games, and internet piracy. The stories are heartwarming, funny, and honestly, sometimes a little embarrassing. I don't ask for donations to keep this podcast running, so if you'd like to support me and see new episodes of the podcast, please head on over to my website at tomotama.com/books. That's tomotama.com/books. And order a copy of Mages and Modems. There you'll find a DRM-free ebook edition and a beautifully printed paperback edition that I actually designed myself. I hope the stories bring back for you some of the warm memories of the DOS, Windows, and Macintosh era that we all love.